Raised by Soundfest is coming Saturday, December 7th. Go to raisedbysoundfest.com for more information.
Memphis time, and we're going to feature the Sid Selvage stereo session featuring me, Robbie Grant, along with Pat Sansone, host of Broke Down Palace, and Sid's son, musician Steve Selvage. This is recorded back in September featuring Sid Selvage's classic record Portrait. Enjoy.
Steve, Robbie, we've never done a panel together.
Are you sure?
Oh, no, we have. We did.
Maybe like a Crossroads in the 90s or something.
No, yeah, that was bad. tell us a little bit about the Sid Selvage Portrait came out in 69.
Yes.
69. Walk me up to that, you know, a quick history of your dad and how he got to that record.
Okay, so my dad was, a graduate of Southwestern University, now Rhodes College, was in the coffee house folk scene, kind of quickly made a splash as, you know, a singer, folk guy. got in on the ground floor with John Fry at Arden. And so then, you know, fast forward to, like, you're getting into this era of, like, post-Beatles kind of stuff. So Don Nix was writing and demoing songs. So he would write a song, and that we need somebody to sing the song. So they'd say, call Selvage, he can sing anything. So I think John Fry would get a plane to fly my dad back to, because he was at Washington University in St. Louis doing graduate work. Fly back to Memphis, sing a song, and then go back. And then when Isaac Hayes started Enterprise Records, as I understand it, I could be, you know, paraphrasing here, but they're like, they had Hot Buttered Soul ready to go. They were like, we need a rock band, psychedelic rock band. That was Moloch. And we need like a folk singer. And that was my dad. So they had all these songs that already had been recorded. And then my dad kind of went a quid pro quo back and forth with Nix, like, okay, if you do Only the Children Know, I'll give you Amelia Earhart, or, you know, because that was like in my dad's set. Yeah. So they did the record, sent it to Texas, put the strings on it, and put it out. And that's the Cliff Notes version.
And knowing your dad as we were growing up, I mean, I can just say it. He did not like this record, really. It was like something for him that was, he saw himself as a folk singer, kind of stripped down.
Yeah, I mean, more than disliking it, he thought it didn't represent who he was. Right. And, like, he wasn't going to go out on the road, you know, like Glenn Campbell style with the backing tracks, you know, only with the children. but, I mean, we talked about it. And, I worked on him till 2013, just chipping away. But, come on, it's a good record, man.
Yeah, right, yeah.
He was almost there. He was so close. But, I mean, he definitely recognized that, like, Going Through Another Change is a great song and a great recording. And, you know, again, you know, there's other things, like, I don't know if you heard that track By Your Side that was on, I think, the second it came from Memphis Comp. They were always in there, just especially with John King, just, like, throwing stuff at the wall, trying to get a hit, you know, because, like, that's when you could just do a single and get it in regional radio, you know, and just see what stuck. So, you know, I think more than anything, it was just like, this isn't really who I am. And also because the record was doing okay, especially regionally, Ballad of Otis B. Watson was starting to get some traction on radio. Mm-hmm. My mom tells the story that she was changing my brother Sidney's diaper in 1969, because that's when he was born, and she heard the Ballad of Otis B. Watson on the radio.
So she made it.
Oh, here we go. To the toppermost of the poppermost, baby. And then they decided that Otis B. Watson had anti-war content. It got squashed.
Well,
you know, a familiar story.
I'd like to think of him performing that, like, with the whole orchestra.
So apparently, they erased the tape when he was on George Klein, the WHBQ, like, just like the Box Tops, but, like, lip syncing Ballad of Otis B. Watson, and I would give my eye teeth to see that.
Yeah. So Pat, welcome. Tell us about how you found this record and what it means to you.
I found the record at Shangri-La one day. I believe it might have been the day that we did the Mellotron thing here. I think I was in town for that. I came It was Record Store Day.
Yeah, April. Yes, yeah.
Swung by Shangri-La, and you know, just flipping through records as I do, and I saw it in the bin. I already knew the Cold of the Morning record, which I love, and so I was familiar with Sid and that part of his work, and just thought, oh well, I definitely gotta get this. Oh, 1969. Yeah, right, and that's right in my zone. And took it home and didn't really know anything about the record. I knew zero about it. I didn't know what I was in for. And I put it on, and within the first 10 seconds, I fell in love. I was like, this is so up my alley. It checks all my boxes. And then looking at the credits and seeing it was recorded at Ardent, seeing that John Fry recorded it, seeing Don Nix's name, I was just like, how is it possible that I have never heard this record? Because, you know, I am a deep lover of orchestral folk and pop music from the 1960s and 1970s. I do a 2-hour radio show dedicated to that very thing at WYXR. So it really kind of blew my mind. Not only just the deep beauty of the record, I mean, the sort of smooth, soulful, earthy voice of Sid's, the incredibly masterful string arrangements that are cinematic and romantic, and I mean, they're very ornate, but they're never, to me and my personal taste, they're never overblown. They're just in that sweet spot. The musicians, the players, I mean, the rhythm section on this album is incredible. And we were talking about it earlier, we've talked about this before. It's a very particular kind of playing that is kind of connected to the South. I mean, you hear the Southernness in the playing. It swings in a way that really only music from that period can swing. So you've got this beautiful foundation that's Southern and swinging, but then you have this cinematic landscape along with it. So to me, I believe it's really a lost Southern Baroque pop masterpiece.
Yeah. And Steve, it's not in print. It's not streaming. I mean, this truly is one of the only ways you're going to be able to hear it if you don't have the vinyl.
Ballad of Otis B. Watson is on the DSPs.
Okay.
yeah. And I think that's it. Maybe going through another change, but I don't think so.
Yeah.
To my knowledge, it's like Enterprise went to Fantasy, which went to Concord. So, I mean, I don't know. I'm not involved with this. So.
Well, one of the first conversations that you and I ever had was, I got your number from Robbie.
That's right.
Because when I discovered the record, I was like, I got to talk to Steve.
Right.
So I called you and immediately was like, number one, what's up with this record?
Yeah.
Number two, how do we get this thing re-released?
Exactly. Yeah.
And we should still
continue
to talk about
it. It's a work in progress.
Yeah.
We just put it out there to the internet.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, I mean, Light in the Attic did the Moloch record, right?
I think so, yeah.
So, I mean, it's there in the Concord vaults.
This is a record that's made for Light in the Attic, you know?
Most definitely.
Yeah.
We have everyone's email. We can get them to petition to get it out. So.
But yeah, I don't really know, nor do I have the time or resources to devote to it myself. But
that's fair. That's fair.
But yeah, I would love to see it. You know, I'd love to be able to be like Alexa going through another change.
Yeah, yeah.
And just to say, you know, the kind of mystery around the album, the fact that we don't exactly know who played on the record, although you've discovered who played bass.
Yeah, so when I was working at Rod and Hank's Guitars in the 90s, Ray Sanders, bless his heart, a great bass player who has been around since the Beatles showed up and everything. He would always come in and be like, man, I played on your dad's record. And I'm like, cool. But he was super sweet. And then, like, he picked up a bass and started playing. I was like, damn, yeah, you did. I know that. I've tried to piece together who played on what, like, especially who the drummer was, because the drumming on that is, like we were talking about, it's that before the Beatles hit, if you were going to learn to play drums, you had to learn jazz. And if you had to learn jazz, you had to learn how to swing. So you have this sort of southern backbeat meets swinging jazz kind of thing that it's a sort of a lost art.
Yeah. And that kind of also, I think, connects it to, like, if you're familiar with the records of Scott Walker, the English, you know, he was an English pop star who in the late 60s started making these very adventurous, ambitious orchestral pop records. Right around the same time, I think his first record in that of that kind was in 1969. So parallel to this record.
Certainly. That, well, and like to, you know, the elephant in the room, it's all also kind of post-Pepper.
Yeah,
you know,
sure.
I mean, if you listen to, like, I've always, like, you know, Miscellanea is like that super compressed, I'm assuming it's the Fairchild, piano, you know, it's like that's definitely... You know,
well, you can hear the there's sort of an English influence in the production. It also, there's like Simon and Garfunkel bookends, which had come out the year before, which was a very influential record, you know, in this kind of orchestral, ambitious, cinematic
And that speaks to John Frye being so forward thinking, you know, being like, okay, not only like people are like, we want to be the Beatles. He's like, I want to know what gear they had.
Right.
And I'm going to get it and bring it back to Memphis. Right. You know, we're getting a little technical here. But
but the fact that, you know, you're talking about Sid not having a deep fondness for the record and maybe being kind of self-conscious about the production. You know, I mean, that wasn't an uncommon experience. There were a lot of artists of that time who... you know, wrote their songs, performed their songs in more, you know, simple, stripped back ways. Then they worked with a producer who really wanted to, you know, kind of flex their production muscle. And then the artist is not happy. Like, you know, the one famous example is Nico, who hated the strings and flutes on Chelsea Girl,
right,
which is considered one of the classic records of Baroque pop music, and that record would not be the record that it is without those arrangements. Nick Drake, who made you know three of the classics of this genre, and this record kind of reminds me in a way of Nick Drake.
I tried to get my dad into that. His only response was, "God, he sure does have some dead strings on that guitar." Oh. I was like, "That's all I'm gonna get."
and it might have reminded him of this experience.
I mean. Is like my dad being a great accompanist himself, great guitar player, but primarily he was a singer. So when you're a singer, it's like, you know, you can tell the tunes that he played guitar on. They're very stripped down. They're just guitar and voice, and that's him. But everything else, I think he pretty much just got in front of the mic and sang. And then that's when everybody sort of adorns everything. And again, like I said before, they were just demos and they were pretty stripped down until the deal with Enterprise came, and that was only then when they sent it off to Texas to have the orchestra put on, because you know, to make it more, I guess, commercially viable.
Well, it is interesting how these things kind of go in cycles, you know, music that to us when maybe we were kids, you know, you'd hear a Glenn Campbell, you'd hear Wichita Lineman or something on the radio, and maybe when we were kids it sounded like easy listening music. That was my grandmother's music. But now I listen to it, and it seems like almost like avant-garde.
It's new every time I listen to it.
Yeah, because it's so sophisticated. It's so deeply arranged, you know. And a lot of times these things just, they don't even hit the people that are involved in making them.
For sure.
They can't see the whole of it.
Yeah, that almighty context. I mean, that's why I just worked on my dad so much, because it was just like, especially as I got a little bit older and your record collection grows, it was just like, I know, but this is really cool, though. I mean, you know. But yeah, I mean, it was AM radio.
Yeah.
You know.
High on a dark and dusty mountaintop in 1943. How lucky can you be? Mama died when he was only five. Daddy got killed trying to keep him alive, and he was left alone. He was almost grown. some neighbors from next door. 13 kids are sleeping on the floor in a two-room shack with the wind to his back. Working in the fields in the heat of the day, dreaming of a place so far away where he could be free. And now he's free. And now he's gone. How many others are left to carry on? Oldest B. Watson went off to war. Didn't understand what he was fighting for, but he died like a man. It's hard to understand. Now high on a hill near Little Rock, a tombstone stands where a young boy grew up into a man, a full-grown man. And now born near Little Rock, high on a dark and dusty mountaintop in 1943. How lucky can you be?
Listening to another edition of Stereo Sessions featuring Robbie Grant, Pat Sansone, and Steve Selvage.
What y'all think? Yeah. Incredible. How many folks in here either knew Sid or saw him play or were a friend of Sid? I would think a lot of this room. So he was touched a lot of people and man, hearing that made me miss him even more, Steve. So,
man, for real.
how is it hard for you to listen to that?
No,
record?
Not at all.
No.
Okay. No, I mean, on the real, like, how many people who've lost a parent get to hear him as much as they want?
Yeah. Know? Yeah. That's amazing.
He was so young, though. I mean, like, that's
how old was he? Was he when recording this record?
If I'm not mistaken, some of those recordings can date back to like 66 or 67.
Okay.
So he was 23, 24.
Wow. Okay.
So he was 26 in 1969 when it came out.
Yeah. Yeah.
What were we doing at 26, Robbie?
Not that.
yeah, right.
Yeah. But your dad was, I mean, I will say, you know, personally was a huge supporter of everything we did. I mean,
100%,
we toured the country in the 90s and was, a father to you, a mentor to me. And I mean, I know that really appreciate everything he, you know, gave us when he was here. And I think he would love the radio station, quite frankly.
Oh, he would absolutely love the radio. You might not be able to get rid of him if he was here.
I'd be fine with that. That'd be cool. So talk about the artwork. It's really interesting. It's got a kind of old school feel to it. What's the?
Yeah, it's kind of Western there. I don't know. Yeah, I mean, obviously it's a portrait. Jimmy Chappell took that photograph. Good friend of ours. Grew up with his son Miles. I've actually got some outtakes from that photo shoot. Another fun fact is that my mom made that shirt that my dad's wearing.
Really?
So
she's a seamstress. So I like
yeah, it. My dad was really into kind of that sort of Bolshevik look. I think he had a the people that had the boot on the neck of the working class. but yeah, it's and I remember he still had the, like, he was super into going to junk shops and finding the like gold frame glasses and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
It was thrifting before it was thrifting.
And Pat, listening back to that side A, I mean, where did it take you? And
Well, it's, I mean, it's, I mean, first of all, just the voice.
Yeah.
You know, and hearing, I mean, you know, I can talk about the arrangements and the, you know, the sort of the vibe of the record all day long, but really that, especially hearing it in here on this system, the, that big voice for such a young man that has this, like on Cotton Eye Joe, when he's, the melody, the range of the melody is so wide. I mean, yeah. He's up here and then he goes down to that beautiful low note on Cotton Eye Joe. It's, you can feel the resonance of his.
He had a chest, yeah.
Of his body coming through the voice. Well, and it's a beautiful thing to listen to. It just hits the ear in such a great way. And it's part of, I think, why the record has this. And it's interesting just looking at the cover and talking about the cover and this, you know, it has this kind of, I mean, the record is 55 years old now, but even then it was presented as kind of like a piece of something from a previous time. It's so it has this timeless quality, you know, and a lot of that has to do just with the voice. I mean, it's in his voice, and yeah. It's really something else.
I mean, Dylan famous. I mean, he asked about him when he was working with Dickinson. Like,
yeah, who's that voice?
Yeah.
The funny thing when you mentioned the low thing, like you hear it again also in Going Through Another Change. You know, Reed is in.
Yes.
And Nick's
called
that,
which is incredibly moving.
Oh, my God.
I mean, Going Through Another Change.
That's the highlight for me. This song, yeah, that recording, beautiful. That song is perfect. I put it up there with Wichita Lyman and all that stuff. But Nick's would call that the Big Apple, you know, because the Adam's Apple. So he's like, come on, Sid, give him the Big Apple. And he's, Reed is in LA, you know. Another thing, Going Through Another Change, there's that and my dad didn't want to do that. And Nick's was like, just come on, do it. It'll be cool. And then he did it. He was like, yeah, okay, it was cool.
Well, this is kind of the this is really sort of the magic and the mystery of collaboration. Because, I mean, this record is the sum of the artistry of your dad's incredible soulful voice. These songs written by Don, which are beautifully written songs.
Not a bridge in the bunch.
and these sweeping, beautiful arrangements. So, I mean, it's really the record is a collaboration of these forces creating something that's bigger than the sum of its parts.
Well, and two, I think, you know, not to throw shade, but a lot of people were trying to throw this kind of production together with less than stellar results. You know what I mean? Like it can so easily become hackneyed. And sort of like a parody or a,
and it's amazing too, listening back to it and thinking about, and that was a question I was going to ask, so I'm glad you asked, like how young he was, mm-hmm. and just the stars that have to align to be able to create a piece of art like this, you know, a young man like Sid at the time having the access to this incredible recording studio here in Memphis
John
with one
Fry.
Of the one of the great geniuses of recording. And I mean, these arrangements sound expensive to me.
Yeah.
You know, this isn't just like, oh, I know three guys that play in the college, yeah, the
Let's
college
go to Memphis
orchestra.
State and grab somebody.
Yeah. This is top shelf arranging, and I'm assuming, Judge, and this isn't on the record, but looking at a couple of Don Nix's solo records that use the same arranger,
yes,
that it was probably the Dallas-Fort Worth Philharmonic.
Yep.
So that's the forces that have to come together to make that happen for a 23, 24-year-old voice like this is pretty, it's just magic.
And it's so uniquely Memphis, too, because it was like you had Ardent rising, because by 69, Ardent was basically Studio B for Stax. And you have the community around Ardent that would, you know, a couple of years later, beget Big Star, you know. And then you have, I guess, by 69, kind of the might of Isaac Hayes and Stax behind that.
Right.
So, yeah, like you said, there's this confluence that really, but it all came from Memphis.
Well, that is amazing. I mean, to think about just the incredible the incredible generator that Memphis was in this time period, the amount of music that came out of not far from where we are right now, it's just mind-blowing. And that's another reason, like, for me personally, discovering an album like this, when, you know, I have searched record shops all over the country, all over the world, looking for records like this that were made in England or made in Europe or made, you know, things that just seem so far away. Like, this is just something that just happens somewhere far away from where I'm from. And then I land on this record and I was like, oh, I know some of these people, you know. this was made just a couple of hours from where I'm from. I mean, that's, it's very inspiring, super inspiring.
How, so the record didn't do great. How did your dad feel about that after? Was he ready to move on, or was he, did it take him a while to kind of get back going?
So it was like that kind of happened, whatever, you know, the single got squashed or whatever, but then he was still sort of working with Nick's, and then, he got a deal with Elektra. And so some of his tunes were on there. By that point, he had written Frank's tune, if you're familiar with Cult of the Morning. I think he'd written The Outlaw. Mm-hmm. But both of which songs, by the way, he wrote at the bottom of a swimming pool with scuba gear on. Fun fact. But
can you go into that a little bit more?
not really, because whenever I'd be misbehaving in the pool, he'd say, you can go swim in the bathtub if you're going to do that. But anyway, so he went down to Muscle Shoals to record kind of what would be that record, and kind of caught the Swampers sort of at the tail end. Mm-hmm. They've done a lot of sessions, and they're maybe a little crispy, except for Eddie Hinton. He was really kind to my dad. But so long story short, he was like, had a choice between doing his dissertation and becoming a PhD in anthropology or following this music path, the major label deal, Elektra.
Sounds familiar.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so he threw it all in and did the record, artwork done, mastered, I mean, as in the can as it can be, and somebody bought Elektra, and they said, we got three folk singers, we need one, and that was Harry Chapin. Yeah. which I wound up in his house in the late 90s because a friend married his daughter, but that's an aside. But so anyway, after that, like, you know, Moloch, Lee Baker, Jim Dickinson had a record on Atlantic, and my dad had this thing. And then by the time the early 70s came around, they were like, we're done with this machine. Mm-hmm. And so that's when the thing was like, let's make a band that can't get signed. That's the antithesis of that. And that was Bud Boy and the Neutrons. So.
Well, that's incredible.
So bright, don't you cry. Go to sleep, little baby. When you awake, you shall have all the pretty little horses. Blacks and green, dapples and gray, coats and six little horses. Bye. Don't you cry. Go to sleep, little baby. So bye. Don't you cry. Go to sleep, little baby. Down yonder in the meadow lies my poor little lamb. Bees and butterflies pecking at its eyes. Poor little thing is crying, mammy. sleepy little baby.
Out of time. and the memories of a lifetime. All I have to show. Sun comes up, sun goes down. Prison walls, all I see. Just a face without a name. It's all I'll ever be. Oh, sometimes days together. Time days together. Time days together. Time days together. Just a spot on the ocean, just a speck against the sky. Amelia, your heart line sat that day with a pilot, Captain Noonan, on the 2nd of July. A plane fell in the ocean far away. There's a beautiful field far away in a land that is fair. Happy land ends to you in your heart. Farewell, First Lady of the air. A half an hour later, SOS was it, a signal weak but still a voice was brave. Oh, in shark-infested waters, the plane went down that night in the blue Pacific to watery grave. There's a beautiful, beautiful view far away in the land that is fair. Happy land ends to you, Amelia Earhart. Farewell, First Lady of the air. Well, now you've heard the story of that awful tragedy. We pray that she might live to fly again. Oh, any years to come, though others blaze a trail across the sea, we'll never forget Amelia and her plane. There's a beautiful, beautiful field far away in a land that is fair. Happy land ends to you, Amelia Earhart. Farewell, First Lady of the air.
You're listening to another edition of Stereo Sessions featuring Robbie Grant, Pat Sansone, and Steve Selvage.
How was I heard side A again. So how was side B? Any thoughts from side B in there?
It was delicious.
I love side B. Side B is the psychedelic side.
Yeah. Okay.
You know.
Yeah.
I mean the opening those first three opening songs with the chimes and the kind of, you know, the bits of sound collage, if you will. Very ambitious and
sweet.
It is a suite.
Yeah.
It is a suite. It's truly, truly beautiful.
And, you know, I mean, for me, it was just like, again, going back to Ray Sanders, like, Only the Children Know, the bass is just crushing it on that. It's just so good. I mean, one thing that's really touches me is, like, I can tell the difference between, like, sort of the songs where my dad just sang. And the one thing, like the through line for me as a kid, especially loving guitar at an early age, is that to my DNA, I know the sound of my dad's guitar, his J45, the way he played it. And so I can always tell which song is him playing it. So it's like I can hear that thumb, you know. It's really even beyond the voice that touches me so much.
Yeah. And it's just his voice, right?
He does all the doubling and harmonies. Yeah. Okay. And he played mandolin on a Wreck on the Highway.
Okay. That's cool. Later in his life and younger in your life, you got to play with him quite a bit. I mean, you played around town a lot. Y'all even played Carnegie Hall together. What was it like, you know, getting to play these, you know, some of these songs and other songs with your father?
I mean, it was great, you know. I was obviously honored to do it. I can't remember when it was, how old I was when I found Portrait, but what really, as a kid, the first thing that was just like hearing him do Amelia Earhart, it just blew my mind. Mm-hmm. So it was great, like, you know, after a while to get to do that and sing the harmony with him doing that, because it was, I mean, that's the biggest thing, is because we kind of took different paths or whatever, but doing the blood harmony thing was the biggest treat, you know, just singing.
Was Amelia Earhart a song that he brought to the record? Like, was that something that was in his repertoire?
That was in his repertoire. Same thing as a Hushabye was part of his Coffee House Bitter Lemon act. You know, you can kind of tell which ones are. And again, that was Don Nix. It was just like, when there came time to do a record, he's like, I want to do something that of my repertoire, you know. So he was like, if you do the Children's Suite, then we'll give you Amelia Earhart, that kind of thing. But Wreck on the Highway. That's definitely 100% the Bitter Lemon, because him and Jim Dickinson were like always in competition for a lot of things, but like to who could find the most obscure song to cover in the coffee house, you know.
Well, I think that's one of the beautiful things about the record and kind of what makes it work among many other things, but the fact that you do have these very ambitious, sweeping, symphonic pieces, but it's brought back to earth by these songs that obviously your dad felt very connected to and are very, very connected to kind of the folk tradition. So it's not just all sort of airy and cerebral and lush. It brings it back to the earth, and kind of that balance is the thing that makes the record deeply gorgeous, but also timeless, like we were saying. It's like a record that, I mean, it definitely is a record that is of its time. Like, it could only be made between 1967 and 1969. Yeah. It is of that time.
Oh, believe me, I tried.
Yeah, and a lot of people have, include, I've kind of based my whole musical career on it, on trying to make this record. And we'll continue to do so. But where was I going with that? But
just how it's of a time.
Of a time, but timeless at the same time. And those are the records that are truly that truly make deep impact in people's lives.
Well, and two, I mean, it speaks to the, I mean, just like, because look, if you just listen to it without the vocals, it'd be neat. It'd be good, you know. But the human element, what the difference of the human voice, right, and how that resonates for all of us. But then you get the right voice for the right thing. It's like, that's the real magic intangible to me. Like,
it's interesting that you're saying that. I hadn't really thought about this before, but the fact that he is doing all the vocals, so there's not other voices, there's no choirs, there's no background singers, it's all him. And so that really brings you in to, even though it is this very expansive record, you do feel like you are sort of in someone's internal world, you know, you're kind of inside someone's dream, right, in a way. And that is kind of also tied in a way to, I think, maybe why I connect this with Nick Drake, because that is also the case with Nick Drake. Like, certainly, one thing about Nick Drake's records is, yes, these beautiful string arrangements by Robert Kirby, but a finger picking close mic'd acoustic guitar and just one voice. So you have this big wide sound world, but you are right there with
You've
one person.
You got that tip of the spear. I love what they said about Pink Moon: one man, one guitar, and one overdub.
And what record was after this? Cold of the Morning was after
Cold,
this.
Yeah, one. So after all
and
the
he started Peabody.
Yeah, Peabody Records. Yeah. John, stand up and show him the
yes t-shirts at Shangri-La. Yeah.
After the whole debacle of like major labels and doing all that kind of stuff, he's just like, you know what? I've built up this repertoire playing at the Procope, which is now the barbecue shop of Madison. He had built up a whole set, and he was like, I'm going to go in and document the set. So that's that was the first record that Dickinson produced. And so they would go in every morning. And again, this was sort of still like the Ardent family.
Wow.
And so, yeah. So anyway, that's Cold of the Morning came out of the antithesis of, you know, everything else.
Yeah. And did he say, I don't remember him singing around the house much. I mean, I remember him when we hung out a lot in high school and he'd come home from his North End gigs and be like, you know, he'd had enough, but yeah. I don't remember him singing around the house when I was around, at least.
No, I mean, you know, to illustrate a point, he might, you know, like if he was telling a story about a song, he would kind of, or you know, or a song he did or a song he liked, you know. But no, I remember Dickinson saying, I mean, it's probably a production thing, but he was just like, God, if I could sing like Selvage, I'd never talk. I'd be like, hello, how are you? But he could yell real well, yeah. Though. Yeah. Deservedly so on my part.
And you spent some time with Don Nix talking to him about this record.
A little bit,
right?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
What did he have much insight?
Well, the whole like sort of trading of songs.
Yeah,
you
right,
know,
right.
And you know, he loved the record.
Yeah.
Rightfully so. And yeah. they were tight. Like he told me that this is an aside to Pat and I's other sort of passion. My dad was hanging out. He was hanging out with my dad in their house in Germantown, and my dad gave Don Nix a camera, just like I can't remember what brand it was, but just an SLR camera. And Don, and it was just like he had him getting basic sort of aperture thing, whatever. And Don just went off and took all these amazing photographs. Have you seen his?
I have actually. I was at Shelter Studio in
Tulsa
last year. We were on tour and we had a couple of hours there to tour, and they had all these incredible photographs on the wall, and I asked about them, and they were Don Nix's photographs, and they were fantastic.
Yeah, I mean obviously he was around some amazing stuff, but he had a good eye to capture it, you know. And
support for WYXR comes from the Halloran Center for Performing Arts and Education, setting the stage for everyone. The Halloran Center, next door to the Orpheum, invites you to be in the center of it all through live entertainment, arts education, community programs, and event spaces all year round. More information at orpheum-memphis.com.
I'm DJ Alpha Whiskey, host of Flight Risk, and you're listening to WYXR 91.7 FM. As a nonprofit community radio station, we rely on the generosity of donors like you to keep your favorite programming on the airwaves. Become a contributing listener today at WYXR.org/donate.
This is Clockwork Keys with Crosstown Brewing Company. Support for WYXR, including the 2024 Raised by Sound Festival, comes from Crosstown Brewing Company. Our kitchen is now open and serving liquor and wine along with our craft beers. Kitchen hours are Monday and Tuesday, 2 p.m. to 9 p.m., Wednesday through Saturday, noon to 9, and Sundays, noon to 7. Now accepting reservations for corporate and